Okay, thank you. Good morning. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about parent-mediated approaches to treating social skills for adolescents and young adults with high-functioning autism spectrum disorders. Just to give you a little overview of what I'm hoping to talk about for the next 25 minutes or so, I wanted to start with an overview of parent-mediated social interventions for kids with HFASD. And what I think you'll notice as I'm giving this review is that the research is really focused on younger children. There's very, very little for adolescents and young adults that's peer-mediated. In terms of from where we go from there, I want to talk a little bit about some evidence-based methodological approaches. I'll talk about treatment outcomes for adolescents and young adults using a parent-mediated treatment, and the example that I'll use is peers for adolescents and young adults. Then I'll talk from there a little bit about some of the benefits of parent-mediated social skills interventions, as well as limitations for these interventions, and then from there we'll go into possible future research directions. All right, so when we take a look at the literature, what do we find in terms of parent-mediated treatments? Well, really, again, the literature is primarily focused on elementary school-age children. So this is the study conducted by Jeffrey Wood and his colleagues at UCLA, and you got a little glimpse of some of the findings there. But this was a randomized control trial that looked at this individual parent-assisted CBT intervention compared to a waitlist control group. And what you're going to find in the literature as I'm going through it is that there's this common pattern of looking at, there's RCTs looking at a treatment compared to a waitlist control group. Waitlist control is kind of the theme. So there was 19 participants in Dr. Wood's study between the ages of 7 to 11 years of age with comorbid high-functioning autism spectrum disorders and anxiety. And they attended 16 weekly individual therapy sessions that included in vivo exposure, as Dr. Wood mentioned, but also with parent training and also school consultation. And that's what really makes, I think, Dr. Wood's program unique, is that it does involve this parent-mediated component, which I'm going to argue is actually very powerful in that the intervention continues on long after the actual treatment has ended. All right, so in terms of what they found on this particular study with a CBT intervention is that this parent-mediated intervention actually improved parent-reported social responsiveness on the SRS, and it was pretty powerful. I think it was almost about a 20-point T-score decrease on the SRS. That's pretty tremendous, two standard deviations improvement there. And the nice thing about this is that they actually found that those treatment gains were maintained 3 months after treatment. Okay, this is something that you typically do not see in the social skills treatment research, people going back and actually following up to see how folks are doing after the intervention. But in this study, they followed up, and then they had a nice maintenance of treatment gains. And one thing I will give a plug for is that actually Dr. Wood and his colleagues have adapted this intervention for younger adolescents, 11 to 14 years of age. So that's wonderful, because we really need more for our adolescents. All right, and another randomized control trial, this one was conducted by Marjorie Solomon and her group at UC Davis. They had a randomized control trial comparison of a social skills group. In this case, it wasn't individual therapy, it was group therapy in comparison, again, to a waitlist control group. They had 19 male participants, this is an all-boys group, between the ages of 8 to 12 years, and they all were high-functioning. So they had 20 weekly sessions that met for 90 minutes at a time, but they were concurrent child and parent sessions. And what they found was that this parent-mediated intervention, this group intervention, actually improved things like facial expression recognition on the DANVA. They also had decreases in problem behaviors, improved problem-solving skills, as well as decreased depression on the CDI for younger, less cognitively able boys. So they had very nice findings in that study. In a similar study conducted by De Rossier over in North Carolina, their group actually looked at a randomized control comparison of a sort of a pre-existing social skills intervention that they had to an adapted version of this social skills intervention that was actually adapted for high-functioning individuals that included a parent component. So what makes this study unique is that it's actually an active treatment control group. It's not a waitlist group. And they had a rather large sample size, to that about 55 participants. And participants in the treatment group, this is the high-functioning adaptation with the parent component, they attended 15 weekly 60-minute sessions for the children, and then they had five parent sessions. So it wasn't the concurrent model that we see with Solomon and with Wood, but they did have the parent component in about a third of the intervention. And they compared that to their active treatment control, which was their original intervention that wasn't really adapted for high-functioning individuals and didn't include parent involvement. And what they found was that the parent-mediated intervention improved parent-reported social responsiveness on the SRS, again, the social responsiveness scale. They also found improvements in social self-efficacy. All right, so then we have Dr. Fred Frankel's recent randomized control trial that was published in JAD back in 2010. That's so far away. Children's friendship training is the model. So this is a manualized intervention. And what we did in this study was we compared children's friendship training to a waitlist control group again. In this case, we had 76 participants, so a much larger sample than what we've seen in some other studies. But again, we're still focused on elementary school age children. You know, I'm wanting to talk about adolescents and young adults. That's the focus of this talk. But what you see is that there's just not much out there in the literature. This is sort of what we have in terms of parent-mediated treatments for social skills. So these were second to fifth graders with high-functioning ASD. They met weekly for 12 weeks, and then we had concurrent parent and child sessions. And the whole focus was to improve friendship skills, make and keep friends. And what we found with this parent-mediated intervention was that we were able to improve overall parent-reported social skills on the SSRS, the social skills rating system. We also increased the frequency of play dates with these kids and also improved child self-reported loneliness, as well as popularity. And a very nice thing, we actually went back 3 months later to check and see how those treatment gains were looking, and they were maintained very nicely at that 3 month follow-up. Okay, so bridging on the work that was done by Fred Frankel and his group at UCLA, we developed the UCLA Peers Program, Dr. Fred Frankel and I. And in this particular paper, which was published in JAD in 2009, we did a randomized control trial comparison of this parent assisted or parent-mediated intervention compared to, again, a waitlist control group. And this was with 33 participants between the ages of 13 to 17. So now we're talking about adolescents. All these studies I've been mentioning have really been for younger kids. There's really not a whole lot out there in the literature for adolescents and young adults. All right, so what does peers look like? Well, it's a manualized intervention. It is parent-mediated, and actually it's appropriate for adolescents and young adults. We actually have a separate intervention for young adults that we've currently developed. The parent-assisted component is pretty conservative for the adolescent group. It's all parent component. With the young adult group, we actually have more of a caregiver-assisted model because we know that for some of our kids, they're not actually able to have their parents involved in the intervention. That might not be feasible as young adults, and so they will sometimes have an adult sibling attend as a caregiver, maybe an aunt or uncle, a grandparent. We've even had peer mentors attend as being able to provide the social coaching. And what we do in this program is we're actually addressing the core deficits in ASD, focusing on friendship skills, so how to make and keep friends. But what makes the program a little bit unique is not just that it has this parent-mediated or caregiver-mediated component, but we're also teaching what we call ecologically valid skills, meaning we're teaching our kids and our young adults what people who are socially accepted are naturally doing, not what we think that they should do in certain social situations. And then this is very, very important because I think that's a mistake that often occurs, is that we're not teaching ecologically valid skills. It's a 14 to 16-week curriculum, 14 weeks for the adolescents, 16 for the young adults. They're 90-minute weekly sessions, and they're concurrent parent or caregiver and teen young adult sessions, so they're happening simultaneously. For teens, it's appropriate for middle school and high school, and for young adults, we've tested this program in two randomized control trials for young adults 18 to 24 years of age, although it's probably appropriate for older adults as well. All right, just to give you an overview of the actual treatment, we begin with conversational skills. We know this is fundamental to social interactions for adolescents and young adults. From there, we get into electronic communication, text messaging, instant messaging, online safety. We talk about how to choose appropriate friends. A lot of our kids and our young adults, they're socially isolated. They don't know where to find peer groups. So we have to help them identify extracurricular activities, social activities and hobbies, where they might meet other people with similar interests to their own. And this is important because we know that friendships are based on common interests. So we have to find this network of friends. From there, we get into appropriate use of humor. A lot of our young adults and adolescents have difficulty interpreting humor feedback, and so we need to help them with that. We talk about peer entry and exiting strategies, so how you go up to a group of people and join their conversation, assess whether you're accepted into that conversation, and if you're not, how do you exit gracefully? From there, we get into get-togethers. This is very important and fundamental to developing close friendships. If you have friends at work or at school, but you're not hanging out with them outside of work or school, they're probably not close friends. So we need to know how to actually organize and have successful get-togethers. We talk about dating etiquette in our adult group. We actually do not talk about that in our adolescent group, and I spent an entire year of focus groups on that very topic. So there is a reason. You're welcome to ask me about it later. Good sportsmanship is also very important. We talk about, at the latter part of the intervention, peer rejection, things like teasing and bullying, bad reputations, as well as peer conflict. That would be arguments, disagreements, rumors and gossip, all of these things. And again, we're doing this using ecologically valid skills, not what we think that they should do, but we know what we know actually works based on what people who are socially accepted are naturally doing. And then in the adult group, we also focus on things like peer pressure, how to handle unwanted offers of, you know, drugs, sex, alcohol, whatever it is. Okay, so we use evidence-based methods of social skills instruction. This is very, very important. Parent mediation or parent-mediated interventions are very, very important. We know that they tend to be really, rather powerful, but there's also these other elements that are rather important as well, like a small group format. Very nice to be using social skills training in a small group format where you have an opportunity to practice with your peers. The concurrent parent or caregiver sessions are very important for a number of reasons. One is we're teaching parents and caregivers how to be social coaches to their kids so that they can actually coach them during these teachable moments when we as the mental health professionals are not there. And we know that that's actually true for the vast majority of the time. As mental health professionals, we're there, you know, for, in this case, 14, 16 weeks, once a week for maybe 90 minutes. That's not a lot of time in the grand scheme of things. But if we can train our parents and caregivers in the kinds of social coaching that we would provide, then the intervention actually continues on long after the program is actually over. We also know that parents and caregivers can be very helpful in expanding social opportunities for these young adults and adolescents, getting them enrolled in extracurricular activities, social activities and hobbies, places where they actually might meet new friends. And our young adults and adolescents often need a lot of assistance with that. They don't necessarily know how to do these things on their own. Didactic instruction is very important, providing very concrete rules and steps of social etiquette using a Socratic method of instruction, very important so that the adolescents and the young adults, they are generating the rules and steps through this Socratic method, not you. You're more likely to buy into it if they or their peers are actually generating the rules and steps. You need to follow this up with role-playing and modeling. Then from there, behavioral rehearsal, where the adolescents and young adults are practicing the skills in the session, where you're providing coaching with feedback right there in the moment. And then, of course, this real-life practice is very important to generalization. You need to actually have homework assignments where they're practicing these skills outside of the session. And this is where parent-mediated treatments are so powerful, because parents are not only ensuring that the homework gets done, but they're also providing the coaching and assistance during these assignments. This is really critical. All right, so what did we find in terms of the outcome for the adolescent study? So we've published a couple of different papers on this, but in general what we find on the adolescent group report is that adolescents are reporting increased social skills knowledge as well as frequency of social interactions increasing. So they're having more get-togethers at the end of the intervention. According to parent report, parents are also indicating that teens are having more get-togethers. This is important, but they're also showing improvements in standardized measures of social functioning. So on the SSRS, the social skills rating system, we're seeing a very nice improvement. Typically, across clinical trials, we're seeing about a 10-point standard score increase on the SSRS at that 14-week post-test. And it's typically in the areas of cooperation, assertion, and responsibility. We also see very nice findings on the SRS, the social responsiveness scale. Now, this is T-scores. We typically see about a T-score change improvement of about 10 points. That's a whole standard deviation. And we typically see it in the areas of social awareness, social cognition, communication, motivation, autistic mannerisms. That's pretty much all the subscales. Occasionally, we don't get anything in social motivation. And social cognition is actually the one scale that does not maintain at follow-up. And so we have gone back and done a 14-week follow-up, and what we found was that the treatment gains maintained very nicely, except in that area of social cognition. We also have found additional gains on the SSRS in problem behaviors related to self-control and externalizing. Now, I wanted to share with you some really exciting new data that was actually presented at the meeting by Dr. Josh Mandelberg, who's right here in the front row. He is a developmental pediatrician and did a postdoctoral fellowship looking at long-term follow-up of the PEERS program 1 to 5 years post-treatment. Now, if you look at the research literature, there is almost nothing looking at long-term follow-up for this extent of time. And so we really wanted to go back and actually check in with our families to see how they were doing. He had a pretty large sample. He got 53 participants for this study out of 82 potential participants. So he got a 64% response rate, which is really high for a long-term follow-up study. And what he found was that there was a very nice improvement on SSRS, social skills. T1 represents our pretest, T2 would be post-test, and then T3 over here is the 1 to 5 year follow-up. And what you see is this very nice improvement in social skills over time. And I really think this speaks to that parent-mediated component. We know that our kids are continuing to do well after treatment, because the parents are involved in the intervention. We can only assume this. We can't actually say this for certain, but I think it's a pretty good and safe hypothesis. All right, in terms of SSRS problem behaviors, we see this very nice trend of problem behaviors going down from T1 pretest, T2 post-test, to this 1 to 5 year follow-up at T3. All right, if you look at the SSRS subscales, they're all going in the nice direction that we want them to in terms of cooperation, assertiveness, empathy, self-control. They're all going up over time. That's what we want to see, versus internalizing, externalizing, continuing to go down. And these are all significant from T3 to T1, so from baseline to the follow-up. On the SRS, the social responsiveness scale, we're also seeing a very nice improvement here. So as you recall, I'm sure many of you know the SRS. It's an autism diagnostic screening tool. So high scores are bad, lower scores are better. Most of our kids are coming into the study in the severe range, up near kind of between 75-80. We see a very nice decrease in these autistic symptoms at post-test at T2, and that maintains very nicely at that follow-up. If you look at the SRS subscales, again, all kind of going in the right direction and all significant from T1 to T3. Social awareness maintained, social cognition, communication, motivation, and autistic mannerisms. We wanted to take a look, too, at the frequency of social interactions. So, in other words, how many get-togethers were our kids having before and after the intervention and even years later? Because this is a good representation of whether or not they're actually socially isolated or are they engaged. At T1, at our baseline, on average, most kids were having about 2 get-togethers per month. But to be quite honest with you, they were usually initiated by parents, and they were still calling them play dates. So that's probably not really very developmentally appropriate. But they did still have about 2 get-togethers per month. At the end of the intervention, it was anywhere from about 4 to 5 get-togethers per month. And by the way, here in blue, we're looking at parent report. Red would be the teen report. And there's a little discrepancy, by the way, in that T2 data, that post-testing data. We actually were able to follow up on that when we did that 14-week follow-up study. And we actually discovered that the reason for that discrepancy was that the adolescents were actually having get-togethers that their parents didn't know about. So they were going to Burger King or, you know, Pizza Hut after school and weren't telling their parents about it. And we were really excited about that, because that actually looks pretty neurotypical. That's actually nice to see. And then when we look at the T3 data here for the 1 to 5 year follow-up, this is maintained nicely. There's a little decrease, but it's still significant from baseline. Social skills knowledge also increased from pre-test to post-test and maintained nicely at follow-up. Just to briefly give you an overview of the data that we have on our young adult groups, as I mentioned, we've done 2 randomized control trials using this caregiver-mediated intervention. So instead of parent-mediated, it's actually caregiver, because we don't always have parents involved or able to be involved in the intervention. And what we find is very similar to the adolescent results. On young adult self-report, we see an improvement in loneliness. They're actually feeling not as lonely as a result of the intervention or following the intervention. Improved social skills knowledge. And then according to caregiver report, we're seeing very nice improvements on the social responsiveness scale, again, in the areas of social communication and autistic mannerisms, and also improvements on the SSRS. And again, in those same domains that we're seeing with our adolescents in cooperation, self-control, and assertion. We also looked at a new measure. We looked at the empathy quotient, because we were seeing these findings on social cognition on the SRS. We wanted to see, well, maybe you might see something with empathy on the EQ, and we did see a very nice improvement there. And then, of course, those frequency of social interactions also improved as a result of this young adult caregiver-assisted program. All right, so what are the benefits of parent-mediated approaches for teens and adults? Well, we know that parents and caregivers, they can provide social coaching using ecologically valid skills. One of the things that happens a lot of times is, you know, parents and caregivers, they offer a lot of social advice. But do you think that social advice is always appropriate or accurate? It's not always, actually. Sometimes parents and adults, they'll sometimes give advice that maybe isn't actually ecologically valid. An example of this would be teasing. What do you think most adults tell kids to do in response to teasing? Ignore it? What else? Walk away? And what else? Tell a teacher. There you go. Those are the three things. Every single time I ask a group of teens what people tell them to do, they say ignore, walk away, tell an adult. And then I ask them, does it work? And what do you think they say? Not really, no. I mean, occasionally maybe, but not really. And then I say, okay, I'm not going to teach you to do that. Because you know what? That's not an ecologically valid skill. What's ecologically valid is what kids who are socially accepted are naturally doing. And what they do is they give a little comeback that shows that what the person said didn't bother them and was actually kind of lame. And they'll say something like, whatever, you know, or yeah, and, or your point is, or am I supposed to care? Is that supposed to be funny? And that shows the person that it doesn't really bother them. And it's not reinforcing for the teaser, right? They're less likely to tease you if you do this. Okay, that's an ecologically valid skill. We need to train parents and teachers, anyone involved with these kids' lives, to use these ecologically valid skills when social coaching. So we know that parents are going to be social coaches. We just want them to be good social coaches. We also know that parents can actually help to expand social networks for their kids, get them involved in extracurricular activities, clubs, sports. The thing is, this is another thing parents often do, right? They have their kids in extracurricular activities. But do you think they're always the right ones where they're going to make friends? Probably not. They put them in things like soccer, and they may not be that good at sports. But other kids are doing soccer, so they think that's what they're supposed to do. They might put them in karate. Anyone want to guess why they put them in karate? So they can defend themselves, right? Not get beat up. Okay, but if they're not interested in martial arts, is that going to help them find friends with common interests? Probably not. But if they're really interested in video games or gaming, then maybe put them in a gaming club. Or if they're interested in computers, put them in a computer club where they're going to meet other kids that have similar interests and they can develop friendships around that. We also know that parents are very helpful with things like conflict resolution. They increase the homework compliance in your intervention. They're making sure the kids are practicing the skills and hopefully generalizing these skills in other settings. That's very important. Doesn't really matter if they're just using the skills in your group. What really matters is if they're using them outside of the group and they're using them appropriately. Parents can also act as liaisons between educators, the teachers and the mental health professionals, therapists. You know, we have parent handouts that we give parents every week, and we encourage them to share them with teachers and mental health professionals because we all want to be on the same page providing the same kind of social coaching. We also know that parents can ensure that the skills are actually continued on long after the intervention. And we're going to have better long-term maintenance of treatment gains if parents are continuing to promote the use of these skills after the program is over. And then, of course, these types of interventions are probably going to be more cost-effective. You know, PEERS is a 14-week or 16-week program. It's time-limited. But you see the effects go on well after the program is over, and we really attribute that to the parent involvement. So what are some of the limitations, though, with peer-mediated approaches? Well, one is that we have very few randomized control trials for teens and adults. All of those studies that I was presenting, those were for elementary school-age children primarily. We really don't have a lot of programs out there, RCTs, for adolescents or young adults. We tend to have rather small sample sizes. There can also, you could argue that there's a selection bias. We're only including families that are motivated, parents that want to participate. So that's a selection bias in the parent-mediated literature. You may not also be including parents and families if the parents don't wish to be involved in the intervention. So that's sort of a limitation. We don't use a lot of active treatment control groups in all social skills research. That's certainly a limitation as well. Expectancy effects. So if you have a parent-mediated intervention and you use parents as the primary assessors, how do you know that your results aren't biased because of these expectancy effects? That's also a big limitation. We rarely include independent raters in assessment of social functioning. We need to include teachers and supervisors, people that have access to these individuals that don't know the conditions under investigation. And we need behavioral ratings of social skills. It's very, very important. It's incredibly expensive to do this, and it is difficult because you have to be unobtrusive, but it needs to be done. We need to have behavioral observations as part of our data. And we need to assess the stability of these findings over time. It doesn't really matter in the long run if they're doing well at the end of your program. How are they doing months and years later? That's really the key. So in terms of future directions, I think it's pretty clear. I'm suggesting more randomized control trials, larger samples, more active treatment controls. We need to actually examine parent-mediated versus no parent involvement in our interventions. We believe it's really positive and really effective, but there's really only one study, and that was the one out of North Carolina that's really looked at that. We need behavioral ratings of social skills in natural settings. We also need independent raters like teachers and supervisors, job coaches, that can provide these blind ratings, and we need to assess these findings over a long-term period. All right, so just in terms of other future research directions, caregiver-assisted is also a way to go. Parent-mediated is wonderful, but sometimes parents can't be involved. So adult siblings, grandparents, uncles, aunts, whomever. It's nice to have these caregiver options, even mentors. And then combining parent-mediated approaches with some of the other things we're going to hear about, like peer-mediated, which Connie Casary will be talking about, teacher-facilitated interventions, getting everybody on board. I think that that's probably the future of this particular research. So if you'd like more information about peers, this is our contact information. We also have information in your registration packets, and I thank you all for your time.